You're listening to KCBS In-Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area is talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In-Depth.
Over the past few decades, the opioid epidemic is believed to have claimed the lives of 500,000 Americans. It's a crisis that's been fueled by a seemingly limitless supply of pain pills, manufactured, distributed, and sold by legitimate businesses, some of them among the largest in the country. And as today's guests have documented, even after those companies got multiple warnings that their product was falling into the wrong hands, that supply kept coming. Welcome to KCBS In-Depth, broadcasting throughout the Bay Area and streaming on the Odyssey app. I'm Keith Manconi. Today on the program, we're going to be speaking with two Washington Post investigative reporters about the great lengths the opioid industry went to make sure that business as usual could continue, even as overdose deaths began to skyrocket. Those business practices so brazen that our guests today compare the industry to a drug cartel. Those reporters are Sari Horowitz and Scott Higham, and their new book is American Cartel, Inside the Battle to Bring Down the Opioid Industry. They join us now to lay out what they found. Sari Horowitz and Scott Higham, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us, Keith.
So this conversation is quite well-timed because just this past week we saw a major ruling that could see a $600 million payout to two counties that have been ravaged by the opioid crisis. And this ruling is particularly telling, I would say, because of who the defendants are. That would be CVS, Walgreens, and Walmart, some of the largest pharmacy chains in the country, and companies that I think many of us really wouldn't associate with the opioid crisis. And that really speaks to the heart of what your book has to say. That is just how many corporations and how many people really are implicated in making this crisis happen, Sari.
Yes, very timely that we're having this conversation now because, as you said, a federal judge ordered three of the country's largest pharmacy chains to pay $650 million to two Ohio counties that they were found to have flooded with prescription painkillers. And this is really a landmark judgment that affects CVS, Walgreens, and Walmart. And they're having to bear some of the costs that the opioid epidemic has caused in Lake and Trumbull counties outside of Cleveland. And our book, American Cartel, really explains this. And what it really gets to is that most people think of the Sacklers and Purdue Pharma when they think about the opioid epidemic. They don't think of companies like Walmart or Walgreens. But what Scott and I found in more than a two-year investigation is that while Purdue Pharma and the Sacklers may have ignited this crisis, a lot of these other companies that Americans know pretty well, like Walgreens, Walmart, CVS, Johnson & Johnson, really fueled the deadliest drug epidemic in American history. And there are some companies that are part of this American cartel, according to the DEA, that people have never heard of, like Mallinckrodt, a company based in St. Louis, that actually manufactured 30 times the number of pain pills that the Sacklers, Purdue Pharma, made. And together, these companies form what the Drug Enforcement Administration once called an American cartel.
Yeah. So it really is this sprawling network of companies and interests that came together to really protect this supply, keep it flowing year after year, even as the alarm bells were ringing. But for anybody who has not been following the opioid crisis closely, let's make sure that we set the table a little bit and keep everybody on the same page. Scott Higham, remind us, how did the opioid crisis begin? Obviously, we mentioned Purdue Pharma. There was a role to be played there. What tipped this off? And then how did this grow in scope so dramatically?
Well, you can trace it back, Keith, to 1996 when a drug called OxyContin went on the market. And that was the brainchild of the Sacklers and Purdue Pharma. And Basically, what OxyContin is oxycodone that is time released. And this was supposed to be like a miracle drug. And because it was time released, you couldn't get addicted to it. And they convinced the entire medical community and doctors that it was safe to prescribe this drug, when now internal documents show that that's not true, that it was a highly addictive drug, that a lot of people got hooked on this drug, that you could crush it and defeat the time released function on these tablets, and you could snort it, you could shoot it, and you can get a huge dose of oxycodone very quickly, and it's like the equivalent of a hit of heroin. And so for about 10 years, OxyContin was on the market, ruled the market until about 2006, when Purdue Pharma was fined more than $600 million for misbranding its drug. They had to reformulate it. And at that point, a lot of other companies saw that there was a huge market and a lot of money to be made, and they jumped in with both feet. Sari mentioned Mallinckrodt, their pill. It was a little blue 30 milligram tablet that had an M on one side and a 30 on the other. And that pill became the most popular pain pill on the streets. And a bunch of other companies joined the fray. And so, like Sari said, many of them you are household names, but many of them most Americans have never heard of. There's Activist, which is a big manufacturer of PAR pharmaceuticals. And so what our book does is it really begins in that time frame. I mean, Purdue set the table for this American cartel. And our book begins in 2006 when a guy named Joe Ranazzisi came to the DEA headquarters. He was a pharmacist. He was a lawyer and a street drug agent for the DEA. And he took over the division that was responsible for policing the pharmaceutical industry. And he was appalled by what he saw, and he started going after these companies. And so he's one of our main characters. And when you follow what he tried to do, and he went up against these very, very powerful industry, they basically crushed him. What happens to him is an amazing story. It's almost like you can't believe that it's true.
Yeah, well, you feel that way an awful lot reading this book. It has a thriller aspect to it, and almost kind of a horror aspect in just the sense that you turn another page and you're like, I didn't think that I lived in that kind of society. But again and again, we had these warnings and they weren't heeded, or they were covered up. And I think that that's one of the things that the book really spells out very well, is how much we knew, at least how much some people knew early on. You talk about the DEA. We did have mountains of information about where these pills were going, just so many more pills to these little towns that couldn't possibly have used them in a legitimate way. And questions were raised early on, Sari Horowitz, and yet didn't lead to the sort of outcome that we might expect.
No, I mean, when you talk about numbers, Keith, these companies, manufacturers, distributors, sent a shocking 100 billion highly addictive and dangerous pain pills across the country. In fact, the DEA agents called these executives and these companies drug dealers in business suits. Just to pick up on what Scott was saying about Joe Ranazzisi. So the way that the narcotics are manufacturing and distributing this country, it's a closed system. It's unlike other drugs. In 1970, Congress realized that these were such addictive drugs. They created this system that was very controlled and regulated so that drugs would not leak out or be diverted to the black market. And Joe Ranazzisi, who Scott talked about, was in charge of the diversion unit in the DEA. And he saw that the companies, especially the distributors, the middlemen, so there's manufacturers, they make the drugs, the distributors distribute, and then there's the pharmacies. The distributors were skirting the law or breaking the law, because when pharmacies order a suspiciously large amount of drugs or something that's out of the routine, the distributors are supposed to stop, find out why the pharmacies are ordering so much. It's a red flag. Stop shipping them and tell the Drug Enforcement Administration. And they didn't do that. And so Joe Ranazzisi warned them. First, he wrote them letters. He met with them. They ignored him. They ignored the Drug Enforcement. They ignored the government, basically. And so finally, Joe and his team started shutting down warehouses and forcing these companies to pay millions of dollars in fines. For example, Walgreens was forced to pay $80 million. And the companies all said, okay, we're gonna be better. We're gonna try to control this better. But shockingly, they went and did it again. And again, the Drug Enforcement Administration and Joe Renazzisi went after them and fined them. And finally, the drug industry decided to fight back. They fought first in the courtrooms, in the courthouse, and then when they lost there, they turned to Congress. And they were armed with high-paid lobbyists and Washington lawyers and, of course, campaign contributions. And they were actually, this is amazing, Keith, but they were actually at the height of the opioid epidemic able to get a law passed that kneecapped the Drug Enforcement Administration, weakened the ability of the DEA to come after them to stop the carnage. And then, as Scott said, they went after Joe personally, crushed him and his team, forced him out of government, basically. And this is all about money. They are ignoring the epidemic because they're making billions of dollars.
All right. And we're going to pick up on some of those ideas in just a second. Real quick, for anybody who's just joining us, this is KCBS In Depth, your weekly deep dive into the events and trends shaping life in the Bay Area and beyond. I'm Keith Manconi. Today, we're looking at the complex legal dealings and high-powered politics that helped keep the supply of pain pills flowing, even as the opioid crisis was gathering force. Hearing about it from Sari Horowitz and Scott Higham, both Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists for The Washington Post, and their new book is American Cartel: Inside the Battle to Bring Down the Opioid Industry. So just to maybe complete the picture for our listeners out there, Scott Higham, where were these pills ending up? We were talking about the fact that many more pills were landing in these cities than could really be absorbed. So what was actually happening to these pills?
Well, you know, all roads led to Florida at the very beginning of this epidemic. There was a lot of pill mills. Florida is kind of a Wild West state when it comes to regulation. And so there were a lot of corrupt doctors, and there were a lot of storefront operations where you could just walk in and say you had some back pain and you would pay a doctor $250 or $400 and you get a prescription for oxycodone. And then you walk down the street to another doctor. And so people started collecting all these scripts, and then they would go back home and get them filled, or they would stop at a Walgreens or a CVS on the way home to, you know, Ohio or West Virginia, where is the kind of the original ground zero of the opioid epidemic. There were a pair of CVS stores, and this is in our book. It's kind of an amazing scene where one of Joe Renazzisi's top investigators, a woman named Ruth Carter, he sends her down to Florida because there's so many pills that are being dispensed down there, and so many scripts that are being written, and they're just flooding the country. So she sees in the internal data that there are these two CVS stores in Sanford, Florida, which is right outside of Orlando, that are again off the charts amounts of oxycodone, and there are four pharmacies all told that were getting 11 million doses of drugs within a few months. And so she goes down there and she walks into the parking lot, and it's just filled with, you know, with drug users and drug dealers and cars with out-of-state license plates, and people are selling drugs and doing drugs in the parking lot. And it's like before opening. And so there's a line of customers waiting for the pharmacy to open. And she goes into the store, and she goes to the head pharmacist, and she says, you know, what's going on here? You know, don't you realize what's happening here? This is like an open air drug market. And the woman says, well, I know I'm doing the best I can, but you know, at 2 o'clock we cut off all of our oxycodone sales. And Ruth Carter, the DEA agent, says, well, why do you do that? And the pharmacist says, well, because we want to save our pain medication for our real pain patients. And so there were these kinds of disclosures that were jaw-dropping, and the DEA was like, you know, you guys know exactly what's happening, and yet you're not doing anything to stop this. And the numbers are just off the charts. As you guys know, I was just out in California, San Diego, San Francisco, LA, places that were largely untouched by the opioid epidemic 10 years ago are now reeling with overdose deaths, with visits to emergency rooms. It's just off the charts. So the industry knew what was going on, and as you said, Keith, a lot of these documents have come out because of legal action that the Washington Post took to unseal literally millions of internal corporate documents, along with a lot of data. And so now we can see exactly what the companies knew, when they knew it, what they did, and what they didn't do.
Yeah.
And just picking up on something Scott was talking about. Yeah, I'm just to pick up on what Scott just was talking about regarding Walgreens. And again, the question is, how much did the companies know? When did they know it? Back in 2011, in a small town in Florida, Oviedo, Florida, there were two Walgreens pharmacies. And these Walgreens pharmacies had virtually become open-air drug markets in their parking lots. People were coming in to these stores, to these pharmacies, and they had multiple prescriptions, different doctors, different states. And instead of the pharmacists seeing this as a red flag and not filling them, they filled all of them. And then the customers would go out into the parking lot, crush the pills, inject them, sell them. It was like a black market right there next to the store. And then they'd get on the road and they were high and it was dangerous. And there was a lot of crimes around this. And so the police chief in this town wrote a letter to the CEO of Walgreens and to the second ranking executive and the third. And we've seen the letter. It's now part of litigation. But he said, look, I've got this huge problem here. Your two stores are just dispensing oxycodone and OxyContin and not stopping any of this. And there are all these red flags. There are all these drug users in the parking lot. And he described it. And he literally got no answer from anybody at Walgreens. He said, please help me shut with these pharmacists. No answer. And so in terms of what they knew back as far as 2011, they clearly knew what was going on.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a devilish problem to get a handle on, because on the one hand, we do, and this is something that the companies were arguing, you have doctors writing prescriptions for medication that is a legitimate medication for people in pain, and we have the distributors sending it to pharmacies that have filed these prescriptions, and then we have manufacturers that are giving it to these distributors. So all down the line, you can point to legitimate purpose and legitimate sign-offs. And if you just look at the, 1,000-foot view, it could be difficult until you really look into the details to see where the problem is. And it really, but as you've been saying, plenty of people did look into the details and did find that. I'm curious, how much did this contribute, in your view, to the opioid crisis itself, just the fact that all of these pills were available? Scott Higham, could we have had an opioid crisis of this degree without such a supply?
Yeah, Keith, that's a great question. This did not have to happen. If you talk to people in the drug enforcement world, they said, look, we had these guardrails set up. We had systems and laws and rules and regulations in place to make sure that this would never happen. And this industry and its lobbyists and its lawyers and its allies on Capitol Hill tore down those guardrails. And these pills just started spilling onto the street. And there was nothing that the DEA could do about it. There was nothing that the local law enforcement could do about it. There was nothing that the hospitals could do about it. People were just completely inundated by these pills. And so, you look back on this and you say, could this have been prevented? Yes, it could have been prevented. And, as Joe Renazzisi would tell you, these companies did not want to obey the law, so they just went ahead and changed the law. And, we have all these incredible scenes that you just can't believe that this stuff happened. But the DEA has highly trained men and women who police this industry, and the industry knows this. So instead of having a revolving door that everybody knows about in Washington, there's now just like a one-way street, and they were just taking people, plucking them straight from the DEA, putting them onto their payrolls, tripling, quadrupling their salaries, sometimes even more, going to the law firms that represent these companies. And one of the DEA's top lawyers was the man who actually helped the drug industry write the law that undermined the DEA at the height of the opioid epidemic. It's stunning. And that Congress would have approved this, that President Obama would have signed this into law. It was like either they weren't paying attention, a lot of them weren't. Members of Congress don't pay attention to a lot of the laws that they pass. And then there were a number of legislators who knew exactly what they were doing. And some of them are still in Congress today, including Senator Marsha Blackburn. She was a congresswoman at the time from the state of Tennessee, heavily hit by the opioid epidemic. And she was one of the chief sponsors of this legislation. And she got a lot of money from the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah. Speaking once again to Sari Horowitz and Scott Higham about their new book, American Cartel: Inside the Battle to Bring Down the Opioid Industry. This is KCBS In Depth. I'm Keith Menconi. And so far, we've really been speaking about the first half of your book, which is the, I suppose we could say, almost complete defeat at some points that the DEA faced in trying to rein in these companies, rein in this supply of pills. But then there's the second half of your book where we talk about the legal civil cases, the civil cases that were put forward to get some recompense for these communities from these distributors, manufacturers, and pharmacies. And here there has been some more success over the past several years. So, Sari Horowitz, tell us a little bit about what we've been seeing on that front.
Yes, more than 4,000 cities, towns, counties, and Indian nations brought lawsuits against more than two dozen drug companies. And there was a historic settlement a few months ago. The big three drug distributors, AmerisourceBergen, Cardinal Health, and McKesson, along with drug maker Johnson & Johnson, agreed to pay these 4,000 plaintiffs, cities and towns, Native American nations, $26 billion over the next 18 years for drug treatment, education, and prevention measures. So that's something that's going to be money coming into communities for badly needed drug treatment. The issue, though, is the families of opioid victims are demanding to know why no criminal charges have been filed against any company executives. You know, Keith, right now there are about 40,000 Americans behind bars on marijuana charges, but not one executive of a Fortune 500 company that peddled opioids has been criminally charged. No company executive has apologized or accepted responsibility for their role in this epidemic that's taken more than 600,000 lives, more than the military lost during World War II. And it's not just history. You know, Scott and I can talk a little bit about the fact that, you know, the opioid epidemic right now is worse than ever, even with the Sacklers on the sidelines really now. They're in bankruptcy and Mallinckrodt's in bankruptcy. That's another company Scott talked about. But it's worse than ever, worse than a year ago, worse than 5 years ago. The Centers for Disease Control says that for adults ages 18 to 45, fentanyl poisoning, synthetic opioid fentanyl, is the leading cause of death, surpassing COVID, suicide, car accidents. You know, we're in the midst right now of the deadliest drug epidemic in United States history. So getting back to your question, yes, there have been 4,000 lawsuits brought together. There have been settlements, $26 billion in settlements and more. I mean, if you add up all the settlements now, it's close to $40 billion. But no executive punished, no executive in jail, and the fentanyl crisis is completely out of control.
All right. Well, we only have a couple of minutes left, so I'm going to have to give the closing word to Scott Higham. And I think where I'd like to close this, if you could just reflect on where we're at as a country. You know, a lot of what you're revealing is showing an ugly side of American politics, American lobbying, American business dealings. This is really not how we want our country to function. We like to think that when some kind of malfeasance occurs, the wrongdoers are brought to justice. But in this case, as you suggest, it seems like the levers of power were really turned to an incredible degree to make sure that that didn't happen. So where are we at now? Are we in a better place in terms of dealing with this current unfolding opioid crisis that we're still in and holding people accountable?
You know, sadly, Keith, the answer is no. And, and a lot of the men and women in the DEA who are, central to our book will tell you that they look back on the corporate behavior, not just in the opioid industry, but in other industries. I mean, you look at what happened on Wall Street during the economic meltdown in 2008 and the mortgage crisis. I think one person went to prison for that. And so I think, corporate boardrooms, they look at the bottom line. They see, what their exposure is going to be, and whether or not there's going to be consequences for their actions. And there hasn't really been consequences for their actions. Yes, they paid out a lot of money, but it's like the cost of doing business, according to the DEA. Let's look at that one settlement that Sari mentioned. So the three largest drug distributors in America, McKesson, AmerisourceBergen, and Cardinal Health, along with Johnson & Johnson, they agreed to settle all these lawsuits against them for $26 billion. The day that settlement was announced, their share prices rose by 3% on average. And so they just kind of build this into their bottom lines. And, and that money, the $30 to $40 billion, is going to help a lot of these communities. It's going to go to drug rehab. It's going to go helping addicted babies. It's going to help these hospitals and paramedics. But is the behavior of corporate America going to change? And that's a huge question. And we asked that to Joe Ranazzisi, and he said, I don't think it's going to change because of two main reasons: power and influence. And as long as they have the power and influence and the money to throw around Capitol Hill, and that very little is going to change.
Yeah. Well, it is a harrowing story and a whole lot of harrowing revelations. But we do thank you for uncovering it and bringing it to light and sharing it with us today. We have been speaking one last time with Washington Post investigative reporters Sari Horowitz and Scott Higham about their new book, American Cartel: Inside the Battle to Bring Down the Opioid Industry. Thanks to you both.
Thanks for having us, Keith.
And thank you all for listening. For KCBS and In Depth, I'm Keith Menconi. Stay safe, be well. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to KCBS In Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.